Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the last. The gates are closing. This is the last class of the Moxer overview. And just to remind ourselves, first three classes we did on Rosh Hashanah, that's gone. But Unatana Tokef, you'll hear it again on Yom Kippur because it's that popular. And last time we did Slichot. Okay, if you remember Slichot, 13 attributes, El Melech Hashem Al-Kiseh Rachamim, the introduction to the 13 attributes, and then all the piyutim, all the poems, which we didn't look at in depth, all the poems that constitute that unit. Intro, 13 attributes, poems, that's adding a major bulk to the Machzor, okay? And what we're going to look at today is the last major component of the Machzor, which is vidui, which is confession. And the we're gonna look specifically at how this works. But before we get there, I wanted to just give you the big overview, so we know what we're headed into when we hit Yom Kippur davening. Because although you get to daven five amidas on Yom Kippur more than any other day, you only get to do it once a year. So you might not have remembered this from last year. So this is why I passed out the Machzor structure here. Not the same. The last overly Hebrew and large copy that I gave you was Rosh Hashanah. This is Yom Kippur, okay? So if you just start in the middle, if you see the page with the A arrow pointing, okay, you're holding that as your first page. So go to the first column. You see smack in the middle, Adonai Sfatai Tiftach. Okay, if your Hebrew isn't awesome, don't worry about it. We'll be over with this soon. But also, you're just getting the big picture. It's just the big picture structure, okay? And then we're going to go in depth and translation and everything, okay? So you just see, you have your normal beginning, right? Your first blessing, your second blessing. If you go four lines from the bottom, Atah Kadosh V'Shimcha Kadosh is the beginning of the third blessing. And that's normally very short. That just ends, Baruch Atah Hashem Ayel HaKadosh, Baranai Holidays will be HaMelech HaKadosh. But you have all the insertions, that is the Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, going back to our first class, Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri's position that you should put Malchiot in the third blessing. That takes you all the way to where the A points in, Baruch Atah Hashem HaMelech HaKadosh. That's the end of the third blessing, okay? So far, nothing new here. This is the exact same as Rosh Hashanah. Good? With me? We have one blessing in the middle. This is like all other Chagim, including Rosh Hashanah Shacharit. Only Rosh Hashanah Musaf has the three in the middle. So in the middle we have normal Chag beginning, Atav Achartanu Mikol HaAmim. You're going to get that on Sukkot, you're going to get it on Pesach, you get it on Yom Kippur, okay? And you have Yalev V'Yavod, second to last paragraph. Then you have your special paragraph for the day of Yom Kippur, which also has verses just like the structure of Rosh Hashanah does as well. Okay, so you get a couple of verses introduced by Kaamur or V'ne'emar. I underline them here. That's B with the arrow, okay? So A is the end of the first three blessings. B is the meat of the day blessing, the day of Yom Kippur. Now turn over. And you have, right where C is on the label, the blessing for the middle sort of meat blessing here, two lines, right, two lines above the sea. Baruch Atah Hashem, Melech Mochel V'Soleach La'Avonotenu V'La'Avonot Amo Beit Yisrael, the King who forgives and pardons our sins and the sins of all of the house of Israel, U'Ma'avir Ashmotenu B'Chol Shana V'Shana, and who causes to pass our guilt year after year, Melech Al Kol Ha'aretz, that's your Malchuyot, sort of remnant gets stuck in there, Mekadesh Yisrael v'Yom HaKippurim, your day blessing, okay? That's it. That's the meat of your fourth blessing. So far, it's acting like a normal Chag Amida. Okay, good? Then you're getting to the last three blessings of the Amida, which always show up from C to D on this sheet. Ritzei and Modim, and then here's Shalom Rav, because I brought you, this is from Mara, but or Sim Shalom, and it ends Osea Shalom at D. Okay? That's the end of the Amida. Good, simple, seven blessing structure. First three are always the same. Last three are always the same. The middle one's got the meat here. And that's the end. Missing here is Slichot. Okay? You only do Slichot in the Minyan. So, like Kedusha. So you don't say it in your private Amida. Okay? But when you repeat the Amida, it's going to be in the fourth blessing. And then we have, starting at D, the Vidui. Okay? The confession, which starts, Eloheinu ve'elavoteinu, tavo lefanecha tefilateinu, etc. And you skip down three lines. You see our favorite, going back to our first session, what your highlight part of the machzor is. This is the, everybody loves to flagellate. So we got your Ashamnu, Bagadnu. Okay, that's right there, three lines down from D. And then you've got your Alchets going on into the next page, which run all the way to the last page here. A lot of Alchets. And then if you look at H, that is the end of the Vidui part of the Amida. Okay? So you can see, sort of word for word, the Vidui is almost as long as the entire Amida itself. And they have a little layout here that makes it longer, but it is a significant part of the Amida experience. And when you say it as a private person, an individual, as a silent Amida, you say it after the full structure of the seven blessings of the Amida. In the repetition, this gets transferred into the fourth blessing. So the way it's going to work on Yom Kippur, when you are standing there and you're counting, you're flipping through your matzah and counting how many more pages there are to go. So it's going to, remember, this is our normal icon here. One, two, three, first blessings, right? What is it? Five, six, seven, last blessings. And in the middle here, you're going to have your fourth blessing, the day, plus slichot, plus vidui. Okay? That's how it's going to come in the repetition. All right? That's it. That's the whole structure. That's the whole day. And it's just each Amida that we do is just doing that again. You have different poems. In the Ila, you have a slightly different vidui because they drop the Alchets and they put in a couple other poems. But more or less, this is what you're doing on Yom Kippur every time. Okay? Any questions? We're going to dive into the meat of what vidui is. But right now, just big picture structure. Any thoughts or questions? Yeah.
Sorry if I just missed that you said this, but I thought that they switched. Did you just say that?
What switch?
5, 6, 7, I wrote 4, 2.
Sorry. This is in the public recitation of the Amida, where you also have slichot, and you're saying it out loud like Kedusha and other things you can do with a minion. In the private recitation of the Amida, you do the vidui here. You don't do slichot because you don't do slichot in a minion, and vidui you do after the seventh blessing. Why, we're going to see it when we look in the Gemara. But that's just the convention. Okay? Other structure questions about this? We're ready to dive in. Yeah?
In Musaf, when you have three middle blessings, you insert Slichot and Vidui into which of those three?
Musaf only has three middle blessings on Rosh Hashanah.
Oh, okay.
Not applicable for this. Yom Kippur Musaf has, just like all the other... The Ela, okay. Here, Miriam, whoever just came in, we have some stuff up here. Okay. Good? With me? This isn't meant to be inspiring. It's just meant to help us figure out where we are, okay? So this is like what the machzor is. This is what Yom Kippur looks like, structure-wise. Good? Now should we figure out what vidui is? What confession is? All right. Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to pass out more sheets. Okay. What do you think it means to confess, to lead vadot, to do vidui? If you're just going to throw out some ideas of what confession is. What am I trying to do when I confess?
Acknowledgement of wrongdoing.
Okay, good. Acknowledgement of wrongdoing. And just, I don't know if you're using the word acknowledgement intentionally, but to acknowledge... is the same word as to confess, the same Hebrew word. They actually are, we say, modim anachnu lach, right? That's the beginning of the second to last blessing in the Amida. So modim can be, well, what does modim anachnu lach mean? Let's just translate it. Yeah, we thank you, like todah, right? This is all the same root in Hebrew. To thank, to acknowledge, and to confess. Like, I modeh to you. doesn't mean I thank you. It means I admit to you. I acknowledge that you're right, right? When we wake up in the morning, we say, Modeh ani lefanecha, melech hai v'kayam, shechazarta b'nishmati b'chemla. I am thanking you. I'm also acknowledging you. I'm also potentially confessing to you. You know, did we do Modeh ani here before? Did we hit that? The problem of Modeh ani. Modeh ani, it's written in 1599. You know when that was? Yesterday, okay? Modeh ani was written yesterday because they're trying to figure out the problem of how could I wake up in the morning and not acknowledge God, but also how can I acknowledge God if I just woke up in the morning and I'm kind of dirty, right? And you can take that in any way you want. So I have to do Netilat Yadayim, but I can't do Netilat Yadayim until I'm like conscious. But I can't be conscious without acknowledging God's mastery and presence and returning my soul. So the old Modeh ani is Elohai Neshama Shenatata Bi Tehorahi, right? The soul that you gave to me is pure. How does he keep going? Kol Zman Shanashama Bikirbi Modeh ani Lefanecha, right? They just ripped it right out of Modeh ani. How'd they take it? Well, they went to Tachabad and then they wrote Elohai Neshama. By the way, nobody used to, Elohai Neshama gaining popularity with its musical accompaniment now. Okay, but that was the original Modeh ani. But it has God's name in it. So then, but they realized, but you can't say that until you wash your hands, but I can't wash my hands until I wake up and say Modeh ani, but I can't say Modeh ani until, you see what problem? Took them till 1599 to figure out how to solve it. So they say Modeh ani lefanecha melech hai v'kayam shechazarta b'nishmati rabba emunatecha, no name of God. Good. Now, how are we translating Modeh ani lefanecha melech hai v'kayam? I thank you for returning my soul. Or I acknowledge that you return my soul. Or the confession version of this. You know what they say in Eretz Yisrael instead of Elohai Neshama Shenatata Bi? David Friedman wasn't there. It was Chatati. That's how that was the wake up prayer in Eretz Yisrael. Chatati. Okay? I sin before you. Less popular in Tat Shabbat. I don't know. I'll just say, in Tat Shabbat, they never really get to the end of Modeh ani lefanecha, because it's kind of like, what do you mean? My soul? Where'd it go?
I actually learned that play on words this weekend. We learned a midrash from Reishi Rabbah that plays on the same thing. When we hear on Shabbat, Tol Le'adot Le'Hashem.
Right.
The idea is, it's good to give thanks. But there's a midrash in Bereishi Rabbah that talks about Adam waiting outside the Beit Din after when Cain's being judged by God for killing Hevel, and when he comes out, Adam asks, "What happened?" Cain says, "I was allowed to repent. I did teshuvah, and my sins have been forgiven." And Adam Harishon replies, "Mizmor Shir LeYom Shabbat Tov LeHodot, to admit LeHashem." And like they play on it that way.
Yeah, exactly. The Tov Lehodot LaAdonai in that midrash is it's good to confess before the Lord. It's good. Mizmor Latoda, right? Psalm 100 that we say in daily prayer is that is a psalm of confession. Could also be a psalm of thanks. But I guess what I'm trying to say is whatever Vidui is, their concept of confession and thanks and acknowledgement is overlapping, right? There's something about when I thank you, when I acknowledge you, I'm also confessing to you. You want to add? Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's also, like, I think there's something that I think about, like, in, like, tefillah in general, or, like, especially, or even, like among people, that, like, when you actually, like, really thank someone, there's something about it that I think it, like, really plays on, like some sort of like individual like vulnerability and maybe even anxiety. That's like when you're really thanking someone, that's also like, it really is like a confession.
Great, right? There's some, the act of thanking is confessing. By the way, the root of this word, it's not an easy root to figure out. Actually, nobody really knows what the root is, but One theory is Yud Dalad Yud, which in the two-letter theory of Hebrew language, you know, there's that theory of that Hebrew language actually drew from two letters, not three-letter roots, right? You can do this with, like, pei, resh, anything. Like, liparade means what? To separate. How about lifrotz? Right? To separate, what is that? Lifarek, to break up, right? A perek, a chapter. It's broken up, okay? So peresh obviously meant something about dispersal, and they throw on the last letter. So in this two-letter root, you got yad, right? That is to say, when I thank you, I hand something, I express my vulnerability, I open my hand to you, or I give you something. This is also like korban todah. The korban todah is not necessarily a thank you sacrifice, but a confession sacrifice. Right? Okay, yeah, got it.
I think Rav Shai, one of the ways he puts it is that when you thank somebody, if it was a real thank you, it means that they did something for you that you didn't have or that you couldn't do, and you were able to ask them for it, and which it means admitting a vulnerability, like a real vulnerability that you couldn't have done for yourself.
I have gratitude to somebody for something they did for me that I couldn't have done for myself, so therefore... Couldn't have done it for myself, so therefore I am admitting my own incompleteness, and you have power because I can't do that. Yeah.
The word confession isn't inherently implying feeling sorry or feeling bad for something. Like, so I want to make sure I understand that we're all using it in the same way.
Right.
There's the obvious way, which is like, I did this bad thing and I feel sorry and I want to make up for it. And then there's a way that I have certainly done, I'm sure some others can identify this, where you're like, I did this thing, but I'm not going to tell you I'm sorry for it, because the truth is that it was needed for this reason or whatever. Like, like sometimes you can do something that you feel is in someone's best interest, but maybe like that they're not ready for it to happen yet. So yeah, so admit, right, versus... Mm-hmm. Like, I did something wrong and I know I did.
Right, right.
Just
how much of the wrong valence is here? Yeah. Guilt. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You could have done something for someone's, like, I know, like, as a parent, you probably do this all the time for a kid. You do things that really bother the kid, and I'm sure this even more so as they get into the teenage years, and they're, like, really frustrating. I know, I'm sorry. but, like, the 15-year-old will realize 10 years later that you were right.
Right.
Or 15. So I guess like what I'm trying to kind of differentiate is in this case, are we in fact doing the first kind?
Right. We'll see. I think the context we'll see, at least as relates to Yom Kippur, is yes, I did something wrong, as opposed to I'm admitting something of neutral or maybe even positive, ultimately positive value.
Yeah.
There is going to be some wrongdoing here.
Okay.
It's interesting to relate that to thanking, but yes, as we'll see how it plays out in Yom Kippur, that's certainly the way they take it. Okay, yeah, Anne.
Implicit in this, when you first ask us about confession, is that the person who is doing the doing or thanking is in a relationship too, so that a relational context, so I guess that's sort of implicit that we're not just confessing or thanking in thin air, it's to an other.
Good, right. There's a relationship that's happening here where the...
We want something in return. We're doing it to another and something back come back to us.
Good, yeah, right. Maybe there's some relationship repair that this is triggering or something that's going to be involved
result.
Yeah, with someone else. Yeah, okay, yeah, Benji.
Last time I was at Eliezer Diamond's shiur here at Hadar, and he taught about Vidui, so I figured I'd just...
Please.
Mention as long as we're talking about Vidui again.
I wanted
we
to
actually
go.
He didn't make this connection between these three words and concepts clear, but his thesis was basically that we translate it as confession, but that presumes that we have privileged information that we are then sharing, but actually it's the opposite in this case. So I guess admitting actually might work, but definitely acknowledging or thanking, those are cases in which the other person knows all the information and takes an act of self-reflection, which was what he's acknowledging, to come to terms and then acknowledge it to the other, in this case God, who's already aware of whatever you've done. But
good, right. Good. So it's not like a suspect in the witness room, and it's like they're holding it in, and nobody knows if they did it or not, and then it's the reveal. It's God knows, and it's just a matter of you owning up to it, or you know, facing it.
Who did you just quote?
Eliezer Diamond, who was teaching here last night from JTS. Yeah, you're in.
Well, I think what's also interesting about that is when you think about the purpose of the vidui, to absolve us of our sins. It's like, as soon as I say it, then I'm forgiven for what I've done. But when you're sitting in a confessional room at the police station and they're trying to get something out of you, it's largely so they can punish you.
This is why the midrash that that Josh was quoting is so radical. Tov lehodot. You know, only the detective tells you it's tov lehodot, but actually it's very bad to admit. And the midrashim that say this explicitly: if you admit to a crime before a human king, you're sentenced, and if you admit to a crime before the king of kings, you're saved, which is just the opposite of what you would expect. It's tov lehodot. Okay, so let's see how this plays out on Yom Kippur. So if you look, first of all, just number two, the context of this kind of confession, we talked about modeh, something you say when you wake up, which is actually, in rabbinic mind, and not just the rabbis, an act of resurrection. It's sort of a mini, you know, sleep is 1/60th of death. It is a mini rising from the dead. And so what you do when you rise from the dead is admit, or confess, or whatever with this root, but also going the other way. So if you look at number two, Tana Rabbanan, Mishechala ben Atalamut, whoever takes sick and is about to die, Omrim lo hitvade, you say to him, confess, du vidui, Shekain kol hamumtin mitvadin. For every dead person or person who's about to die is meant to do confession. And this is something that's practiced today. It actually didn't happen, didn't really take root until the Middle Ages, but the idea is that on your deathbed, you also do ashamnu, meaning you do a sort of vidui liturgy as one of the last things of your life, because you're getting ready for death. It's also a practice to do this before you get married. No correlation, okay? it is, the correlation is that you're really stepping through a new identity portal, right? You are becoming someone else, or, it's a significant transition. Yeah, Marianne.
Also, if the dying person is unable to do it for him or herself, then the close person, I remember doing that for my father.
That's right, yeah. It could be a very powerful experience where, this is the... You want to come clean. And that's, of course, related to Yom Kippur. Meaning Yom Kippur is the day where we rehearse our own death, and it's not just the white, it's not just the fasting, it's also this is acts that people who are on their deathbed do, and now we're recreating or inventing our own deathbed that we're about to experience. Yeah.
At the community meeting, I was in the sphere about being a theme of, like, the liminality of a certain mitzvah, and I think you're describing like when you're about to cross over, when you're about to do a transition, you should do vidui. And so that makes sense for why we would be doing it during Elul and on Rosh Hashanah, and maybe even during a certain Meshuvah, but why then on Yom Kippur, which would theoretically be the end of the transition?
Okay, great. This leads us right to the Gemara, okay? Now the bonus, so Talia's question is, why do I do vidui on Yom Kippur? I would imagine that I would do vidui leading up to Yom Kippur. And Yom Kippur sort of being the capstone. Yom Kippur itself has its own kapara abilities, so why am I, I should be preparing for that as opposed to experiencing on Yom Kippur. Now, as a bonus, this Gemara that we're starting with is, for those who are learning Gemara in the morning here, is the section right after the part where you end. So if you want to see it on the Vilna Shas page, where you probably have this yourself, you can flip over to the page after page four that looks like the Talmud. So you can follow along there, although it's a little bit different in the Gemara versus the Tosefta, which is where I'm quoting from. But if you see the arrow on the column here, and it says Tuf Resh, which means Tanu Rabbanan, right, which introduces a Braita, which is a Tanaitic statement that didn't make it into the Mishnah. Who's ready for Yom Kippur? All right? This is good. Because that's what the questions are when you get upstairs. All right? So you can follow along there in your own Gemaras or on page one with the English. Okay? So On page one, so it's a Braita, it's in the Tosefta. Mitzvat vidui, here's the commandment to do confession. Erev, again, Talia's question is why on Yom Kippur? So let's start before Yom Kippur. Erev Yom HaKippurim im chashecha. That's when you're supposed to do it. You're supposed to do vidui Erev Yom Kippur when it gets dark or as it becomes dark. And that's sort of following your theory. That's when you're supposed to do vidui. Aval, amru chachamim, mitvadeh adan, which is one way of saying adam, with a mem, but here with a nun. Kodem sheyochal v'yishteh, shema titaref da'ato betoch achila ushtia. Ah, you're supposed to confess right as you go into Yom Kippur, which is after you have your pre-fast meal. But the chachamim say, you know what? You should actually confess before the meal, lest something happen at the meal and you're unable to confess after the meal going into Yom Kippur. Now, what is that that could happen? One is that you could die, okay? This is the Rambam's idea. You might choke at the meal. By the way, there's a series of Talmudic stories of rabbis who misbehave on the 9th of Tishrei. By the time you get to Yom Kippur, it's like smooth sailing. But Erev Yom Kippur is very, very dangerous, right? Like the story of Rav Rechumi, who only, you know, visits his wife on Erev Yom Kippur. And then one day he's late, falls off the roof. It's, you know, tough stuff. Anyways, maybe you're not going to make it to Erev Yom Kippur. That's the Rambam. And then, that's Rashi. The Rambam has another approach, which is maybe something will happen at the meal. Maybe you will get drunk at the meal, or you'll commit some sort of... Yeah, either you forget to say a bracha, that's what Gabi's concerned about. Or maybe like you'll... Well, let's see. Yeah, whatever. Something goes wrong at the meal, and then you aren't able to say your vidui afterwards. Okay, now, here's where we get a little obsessive about this. V'yafal pi sheitvadeh kodem sheyuchal, and even though you did your confession before the meal, kodem sheyuchal v'yishteh, before you ate and drank, tzarich sheitvadeh la'achar achila ushtia. You need to confess again after you eat. Why? Shema erad davar kalkala b'seuda. Maybe you insulted your friend during the meal. Right? By the way, this rip from Talmudic headlines. What is the meal that brings the downfall of the Jewish people? Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, right? That brings the destruction of Jerusalem. You know, the host who's unnamed, he might have done confession right before that meal. But then the meal happens and he disinvites Bar Kamsa and everything goes crazy. If only he had confessed afterward. Okay, so there's a kalkala that can happen in the meal. Now, you're still in the pre-Yom Kippur phase. However, you need to do a vidui at Arvid, even though you did it at the meal. And even though you did it at Arvid, you need to do it again in Shachrit. You can see where this is headed. You need to do it in the next service. You need to do it in the afternoon service. Do it in the last service. Why? Shema erad bo davar kakala kol hayom kulo. Okay? That is to say, something might go wrong at some point during the day. On Yom Kippur, all you're doing is davening. And still, you have the possibility of sinning all the time. You can never escape it, right? It's just constantly crouching at the door, as it were, right? You're always about to sin. This is the view of one interpretation of this braita. Yeah, right.
Die.
Okay, good. No, but if you die, but the thing is, if you die and you've already confessed, you're good. The question is, let's say I would God.
But if you make it through Shacharit, you could die before Musaf.
But I confessed in Shacharit.
Okay, and if you get through Musaf, you could have died.
But my point is that confession precedes death. But if I confess, so I'm ke'ilu ready to die. But what they're concerned about is not that you might die. They're concerned that you might die if you didn't confess before the meal. Okay? If you choke at the meal and you never confess, then you've died without confessing. But now you've confessed. You confessed once, twice, three. By the way, total number of confessions on Yom Kippur? Seven? Not bad. Someone's counting. Okay? Right? Before the meal, after the meal, and then the five services. Okay? So it's just you can't go 5 minutes without the possibility of something to confess for. Right? Now that either could be like a grim view of human nature or a realistic view of, you know, our own desires. Like, I don't know about your Musaf last year. I mean, I'm not going to say it. Okay, so we need to work on our davening, people, because last year wasn't awesome. Okay, yeah, Rena.
You put it more nicely, be seen as, like, even if you get in a big fight with your mom, then you sleep halfway through the day, then you still have a chance.
Ah.
It's just like, we know that this is going to happen to you.
Good, you're saying maybe it's just you get many chances, right? If you theoretically, in theory, you know, fight with your, or anybody who's the rabbi, whatever, I'm just saying. It's maybe like you get many, many opportunities. It's not like you have one moment on Yom Kippur. Actually, the whole day. And I would say there is something to the repetition of the vidui. There's a reason why people say Ashamnu is like the part they connect to on Yom Kippur. They remember it at least. It's like if you only did it once, you know, you might not remember it, but you're doing it over and over and over again. There's something, you're also doing a slicha, you know, there's something that sticks ultimately, I think. Okay, yeah, Molly.
I found this very troubling. Tell me if we're going to answer this, you don't have to answer right now. So, okay, I'll accept that we're constantly sinning.
Something might happen. Shema.
Yeah.
Maybe.
So many of the sins that are running through my mind is something like people could do sort of like, in a moment, in a conversation, you know, like Lashon Hara, like talking about, or in the conversation, or scorning someone, you know, like I know we talked about not scorning as so these small things that are, I think, make up what they mean when they're, that are constitute part of what they mean when they say we're constantly sinning, I don't confess to God for those, right? I do tshuva with the person directly, because Lashon Hara, I'm screwed anyway, like either you can't take it back, so I mean, there's nothing I can do, I might as well just.
Well, you could admit it.
You could admit it, yeah, so too good. But so I guess what I'm not clear on is why it's saying confession versus do tshuva and actually address each of those things individually.
Mm-hmm. Right. What's the difference? Good. What's the difference between the need to do tshuva versus the need to confess? Yeah. Now you could say, or do you want to comment on that? Yeah.
Yeah, I was gonna say in the Gemara we've been looking at, there's or at least I can't remember any. It's mostly focused on teshuva.
And right.
Yeah. So I was just gonna compound that. So, you know, what is the, why do we do we do it? But you could say that's a part of doing teshuva, right? It's like admitting, or like you can't do teshuva.
You can't do teshuva unless you actually admit what you need to do teshuva about.
Right.
Right. Maybe that's part of it. Now I'm gonna ask you. Okay. Were you raising? No, just stretching. Raising, yes.
Well, actually, this goes to the other point. It sort of doesn't make, it would have made more sense to confess to the vidui in Rosh Hashanah, and then work, because one is Tali's an introduction, point. And then the other is action following an acknowledgement. Tshuva implies a process.
Right.
And vidui implies somewhat like an acknowledgement.
Some verbalization, right.
First, so it is.
You think the verbalization has to come first, because otherwise how could you do the tshuva for the thing that you didn't express yet? Right. And yet, we know that it also is the last thing you do when you're alive. So there's also sort of like, maybe it's the thing that you didn't get to do tshuva for. Or that you can't do tshuva for fully. You know, say, Lashon Hara. Or, I'm just not going to call my mom at Mincha on Yom Kippur before Ne'ilah. But I want to confess about it. I don't, you know, meaning, there are categories of things that you would at least. Maybe the ideal is the process you're suggesting, but on Yom Kippur, we're aware that you could at least get part of the way of acknowledging it. Yeah, Stephanie.
Unless you consider that you're not confessing for a crime that you committed against another person, but it's a sin against God. In the sense of like, yes, speaking Lashon Hara is
right.
A sin against another person, but by doing so, you're also desecrating God's commandment of not to do so. So it's like Yeshuva, up until that point, is like, with other people,
mm-hmm.
and to make sure, and now you're doing a confession of like, oh yeah, speaking Lashon Hara is bad for them, but it's also bad to God. Mm-hmm. So it's mm-hmm. different. You're acknowledging that you commit essentially two sins, one and one.
Right. Yeah. Well, okay. So this, I would say, this leads us to the next question, which is, okay, I understand that I need to confess, and I need to confess a lot, and maybe it's somehow related to tshuva, maybe ideally comes before tshuva, but it's something that continues even throughout the day. So what is it? How do I do it? Right? The Gemara here doesn't tell you what the confession is. So what do you think it is? You had another comment. Yeah. It's like, okay, confess. What is it?
Just to clarify, when it says mitzvah vidui, is the only knowledge of that the source one, mitzvah vidui is hatatam, or is there any other prior literature about
why you need to do confession on Yom Kippur?
No, about the content.
Oh, about the content.
Just clarifying, is your question mm-hmm. totally true? Because I don't know.
So you're saying if you look at Bamidbar Hey, Vihidvadu et Chatatam Asher Asu.
I'm not saying that has content. I'm saying is that to the Gemara we have here, is that the only literature to this point?
That is an example in the Torah of what Vidui could be. But that seems to be more about when you do something wrong, then you admit it as part of the reparation. Not necessarily on Yom Kippur, but that... Right, as a model of what it means to confess, it seems like, at least there, it's vidvadu el chatatam. You actually admit your sin. So give me an example. What would it look like? Yeah?
I think it also has to do with what you were saying before, but like vidui is kind of like the last resort, and it's something to do with Yom Kippur, and there's some sort of like magic formula to it, and it just kind of works, like kapara. Because like it can't be like tshuva because there's no script for tshuva, but there's a script for vidui.
Ah, okay. So first of all, is there a script for vidui? In other words, if I say to you, okay, we're all on board, confess. How would you do it? What would you? I mean, we could say ashamnu bagat. That's obviously one way it gets instantiated. That's the script version. That's the liturgy version. How would you do it? Yeah.
If I didn't know better, I think it'd be kind of something like, you know, going to confession. In the Catholic
yes,
setting.
Right.
You go to God rather than the priest and say, yeah, I did this, I did that. I think I might have done that. I'm not really sure, you know, help me out with this.
Yeah. And by the way, this year's confession looks different from last year's confession.
Right.
Presumably, you know. Right. I mean, it could look the same, but it doesn't have to. In other words, it's very personal dependent.
Except right. It's all plural. That's the
Well, the ashamnu is plural, but I'm just saying based on what we have so far, right? What do we do? How are we admitting? So Alex's suggestion is you go in one-on-one. You tell over what's going on with you. Yeah, Ariel, for you.
I'm just like wondering in general if there's a precedent for like non-verbal confessions.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, and
mm-hmm.
What constitutes that if it exists.
Right. Yeah. So it's a good question. The Rambam says it doesn't count unless you verbalize it. You have to say something out loud. I'm drawing on earlier sources, but you can't just do it in your head. You can't think it. You have to actually say it. Again, like a court, you know, the guy in the witness box, it's not like he can testify by thinking. So there is sort of like a verbal element that goes along with it. Yeah, you want to add?
Just a second question with that. So does that then like kind of block confession towards people with verbal capacities?
Well, you could say that about a lot of liturgy, meaning you're supposed to say Shema out loud as well. So is there a way in which someone without verbal capacities could fulfill the mitzvah? That would be we could look into that. I don't know off the top of my head, but I imagine that they make some adjustments there. But the basic law is that you do, if you can think and speak, you have to speak. You can't just think. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a couple. I'm wondering if is a korban not a form of confession?
Yeah.
In some way, that kind of seems like one that's like, I don't know how verbal that always was, but it's definitely action-based, but also something that you gave to someone else.
Yes, right. How much of the korban plays into this? By the way, there is a theory that the priests said nothing when they did sacrifices. Israel Knowles, a Bible professor at Hebrew University, says he wrote a book called Sanctuary of Silence. It's one of these great books where the title tells you what the book is. You don't have to read it. So it was like, the sanctuary was silent. Unlike any other ancient religion, there was no liturgy that went along with the sacrifice. And exceptions to that would be like Bikurim, you know, where you actually say something when you bring your first fruits, but that's very unusual. It's also not even the priest who's saying it. So maybe it's, maybe the analogy sort of breaks down at least at this point. Yeah, you want to add?
I'm also wondering, I guess, if I'm thinking of, okay, what is me doing? I'm like, well, kind of like if you ask someone for like mechila or like forgiveness, like I always think about that, or definitely like when I was, I think, growing up, like, you like go up to all your friends, you're like, I need to ask you before Yom Kippur, I need to ask you before Rosh Hashanah. And then it's almost kind of this like modeling of actually this is what you're kind of supposed to do, like when you are in relationships with people, it's
right,
actually these like check-ins that you have.
Right.
Like, hopefully you don't always have to go up and be like, do you know how me? But like, you know, but there's something about it that's like, oh no, when something is going wrong, these are things we're supposed to be talking about and practicing, and that becomes like
good.
Yeah. And I think that's almost like being here, it doesn't seem to be totally mutually exclusive from like, I don't think Teshuva and Midui are totally mutually exclusive. I almost think that Midui is like, oh no, it's this repetition and practice and what that means to like be talking about things you could have done or things you're confessing, and it's like Teshuva is also supposed to be kind of this like small little like incremental shit.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, good. Well, the idea of I go up to someone and say, will you forgive me for everything I've done to you this year, right, is a stance also about what this process is meant to look like. And it's a debate, actually. If you take a look at page 5, just flip over to page 5 since you brought it up, then we're going to figure out what vidui is. But this is an element to vidui, which is how specific do you have to get? So look at source number 14 on page 5. V'tzarich lifrod et acheid. Did you guys do this yet? Yeah? You did it in your... Okay. Right? So, we have the proof. Anachata mazeh chata gedola ve'asu lehem elohei zahav. Ah, I'm listing out what the... And here's, the narrative of Yom Kippur, right? Idolatry, the golden calf. I'm listing out what the sin was. I'm not just saying, God, will you forgive me for everything I did wrong this year? It was, God, will you forgive me for making an idol made of gold? Okay? Specific, right? But that's the Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. But Rabbi Akiva Omer, no, right? It's better to cover it up, right? Please forgive me for everything that I did for you. Please forgive me for all the wrongs I did to you this year. Don't detail it out. Don't spell it out, right? You could, reasonable people disagree about that, right? Now let's just see how, so what is vidui according to the Talmud? Luckily, the Talmud asks, my Amar, what are you supposed to say? So turn over to page 2. Turn back to page 2. All right, if you're in Gemara, it's on the same page in the Gemara. Now, we have here 7 options of what you're supposed to say for vidui. We've got Rav, we've got Shmuel, Levi, Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yehuda, Rav Hamnuna, and Mar Zutra. All right? That's not a bad lineup. Now, without even looking at what they're saying, what does this tell you about vidui? The content of what you're supposed to, my Amar, what are you supposed to say for vidui? Yeah, either we don't know, or what? It's personal. You want to know what Rob said? He said what Rob said. You want to know what Shmuel said? He said what Shmuel said. Right? That is to say, and now it's your turn. Say what you're going to say. Right? Another place where this happens in the Gemara is stuff that you're supposed to say after the Amida. Right? In Brachot, right? It's Tetzayin. Like, many options. Like, 8, 9 options of the things you're supposed to say at the end of the Amida. That is to say, it's open season. You say what you're going to say. I happen to have brought you some examples from other people who said what they were going to say. Now, what happens to this? It's in the Gemara. You have like a little nugget, which is like a tiny piece of liturgy. And guess where that's going to land up? Bam, in the Machzor, right? So what you have here not only is, oh, you, by the way, you could look at this and you'd say, Amar Rav, Atayo Deir Vazei Olam, Ushmuel Amar, Mimama Kehalev, in this version. Many manuscripts have him starting off saying Atayodea. Atayodea im Kehalev, Atayodea Mimama Kehalev. But what's the structure of Amar Rav versus Shmuel Amar? It's a response, right? Amar Rav is a statement and Shmuel Amar is a disagreement. So maybe it's, you know, don't say what Rav said, say what I'm saying, okay? But what ends up happening in the Machzor? Guess what? We're going to say them all, right? We're not going to say all of them. We're going to say many of them, okay? So you will see when you read the confessions here that they may sound familiar to you from parts of the Machzor, okay? So now what's a little bit frustrating here is that you only have the opening lines of their vidui. So you don't actually know the full sense of what they said. My favorite one is Levi, number 3. V'Levi amar, uv'toracha katuv lemor. In your Torah it's written. That's pretty general. Okay? Rashi helps fill that in. But the point is, that proves that this is just an opening. It's not the entirety of what they were going to say. So this is a problem with the Talmud. When the Talmud quotes liturgy, either it assumes that you know the end of it, or we never really had the end of it, and it got lost, and all we had was sort of like the abridged version, and nobody knew it. We do have, as you can see, the later you go down the generations, the longer they get, maybe because they were sort of better preserved. But through various reconstructions, including our own Machzor text, you can see them. So what I want you to do is, if you flip over to page 3, okay, you actually have these 7 confessions spelled out a little bit more, okay? If you look at like source 4 through source 9, okay? So what I want to do is just take a few minutes. I'm going to ask you to just read those, source 4 through source 9. You don't have to get through all of them. You can jump around, you can just stay on Rav or whatever you want. I'm curious what speaks to you, which one you like, or what works for you, and what either surprises you, you're not that interested in, etc. Okay? So just take 3 and the top of page 4. We'll take like 10 minutes, just turn to your neighbor, read them out loud, tell me what you think of them, okay? Let's bring it back, even if you didn't get through it all. Let's hear what you had to say. What came up for you? By the way, you can see, I think I labeled in letters where some of these show up. So for instance, if you go back to that other sheet, if you wanted to see, Rav is... Where is he? Rav is F on the sheet that we the longer 8.5 by 14. Right? You see Rav there, Atayo Deir Vazei Olam. So we're going to say that in our Amida. And the confession of Rav Bibi Bar Avina, which is in source number 8, by Yikaraba, it's in the Rishalmi, not in our Bavli, but also shows up. That's G. And what about H? We've got G is source number 8, the second half of source number 8. And H, Elohai Ad Shelo Notzarti, is who? That's Rav Hamnuna, it's number 7. Okay, so you got at least 3 of them that show up in this Machzor. Okay, of confessions. So which of these confessions, what stood out to you from them? Either things you liked, didn't like, noticed? Yeah, Marion.
Some are in the first person, some are singular, some are plural.
Good, right. The Elohai, right, which is also like Elohai, as opposed to Eloheinu, right, is the singular. Elohai is sort of like a classic opening of a personal prayer. Even whatever comes after it, it's like, you know, this is one person's, whereas most tefillot, we said Ashamnu is the collective, right? We have to be plural here.
And the body of all the al-chetz are also in the plural.
Correct. That's right. Right. So there's a departure from that convention with the Elohai, the singular one. Yeah, not.
So there's kind of 2 modes. One is like sort of like majorly like humbling yourself.
Uh-huh.
Like elevating God's like compassionate attributes. But we like number 8, which is a little more big deal. And it's just like, I swear what I did, that was wrong. I'm not going to do it anymore. Please forgive me. Just kind of like the basics, and it's not like, it doesn't go to the extreme.
It doesn't malign my character in essence. It's just sort of focusing on the sin, not the sinner. Is that?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, you want to add?
Yeah, and I think also like a really core component of confession and acknowledgement, whatever feels to me like it's an explicit articulation of like what I actually did as opposed to like broad comments about myself and my character. Like I think that feels to me, like during the year, sometimes I like walk around with like feelings about myself, but I think like the thing that makes the time year different is like, now I actually think about like, what are the things in a more detailed way.
Mm-hmm. Specific.
To kind of start to get at that, as opposed to like really broad sweeping statements that are kind of hard to like do.
Good, right, and that also gets back into the do you not? Yeah, you wanted to add one more?
It also doesn't like go to great lengths to be like, you're the most compassionate ever. It's just like, we have a relationship, like, my God, will you please forgive me?
Yeah, right, which is also a convention. It's almost like an emergency kind of prayer. You know, we're not gonna spend a lot of time on the lead up, right? It's Elohai.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the full address. It's not a lot of heaping praise and adjectives. It's as I said, it's an emergency. It's, you know, there was a scholar, Hebrew University, Yosef Heinemann, writing in the 60s and early 70s, and he tries to classify certain kinds of prayer. And one of the kinds of prayer that he determines is the emergency personal prayer, which these are examples of. You know, it's not a long and poetic, you know, it's sort of like, I'm going to get to the main point with like a simple address and then jumping to the content of the prayer, which might be sort of like the experience of what Yom Kippur is. It's like, let's cut to the chase. Exactly. Even though we're in trouble for a long time. Yeah. Yeah.
I always kind of found Rav Hamnuna's like hasn't really sat well with me. And
which one?
Rav Hamnuna.
Okay. So number 7.
7. Sorry. And then also it says, like, may it be your will again that I don't sin again, but, like, that's human, that's the nature of humans, the way that God created us, that, like, we're not perfect, that we will sin again, so.
There is a reading, Rav Cook's reading of this Elohai Ad Shelo Notzarti Eini Kedai, if I'm remembering correctly, Akshav Shenotzarti Ki Ilu Lo Notzarti. Before I was created, I wasn't worthy. But now that I've been created, it's as if I wasn't created. The Rav Cook's reading on that is, I wasn't created until I needed to be created. It wasn't worth it for me to be created until it was time for me to be created. And now that I'm created, am I really living up to the reason why I was meant to be? Right? It's sort of like a self-analysis. You know, I'm here for a reason. It's just that I'm not carrying it out yet. Right? I'm not living up to my full potential, my full reason for being, bless you, as opposed to I'm totally ultimately worthless and there's no reason for me. It would have been better or just the same if I wasn't created. It's like we act as if we weren't created, but we could act differently. You know, if we really just stand up to face the reason for our existence, which is not easy, but at least gives a little bit more, reason for us being on Earth. Yeah, Stephanie.
I really liked source number 4, Rob's confession, because I immediately thought of, so he's saying like, Hashem, you know everything, essentially you know everything, you know the secrets, and I'm like, literally no one else in the Tanakh seems to admit this, so I just immediately jumped to both Adam and Eve and Cain, who are like, God's like, what did you do? And they're like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Tov lo don't. Adam doesn't admit, right? Meaning he learns from Cain, right? That's part of what the Midrash is
like saying that, you know, admitting, like, it's similar like a parent. Like, I know I was jumping on the bed. My mom knows that I was jumping on the bed.
Mm-hmm.
Me admitting that I was jumping on the bed is just that act of confession. It's like, that's the part of the shuva process, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, by admitting that you know everything, it's just mm-hmm. like you're saying, you know, like,
Right. Well, right. As Benji was quoting Rabbi Diamond, right? It's not about now the reveal. It's like you know what's happening here, and I'm just catching up. Yeah.
We actually read that as sort of, in some ways, like a refusal to confess, because like, uh-huh. I don't need to confess. You already know it all.
Uh huh.
Like it's sort of a sort of backing away from the need to confess, and I think the way that maybe it makes you feel a little more comfortable. It's like, we don't even really need to talk about it. Like, you already know it, and I know you know it, so, like,
let's move on from there.
Yeah,
right.
It seems like a way of sort of trying to avoid confession rather than, like, a lead-up into confession.
Did anyone see any difference between, I mean, I'm not sure I know the answer, but if you read the version that I was bringing here, the manuscript version, Atayodea Raze Olam versus Atayodea Ma'amake or Me'imke Halev, it's a different. If Rav and Shmuel are having an argument, right? Is there something that they're arguing about? What's the difference between them? Yeah, Talia.
The you know, and also the bakasha at the end, that Shmuel adds this piece of like. And by the way, like, please, like, since you know all of this, like. Use it well, or something. But I was in response to Jamie's comment. A lot of tefillah for me is like the prayer to be able to pray.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't know that I'm doing what I really would like to be effectively doing right now. But I really, really want that. So like, uh-huh. Actually, I'm really praying to be able to pray.
To be able to pray.
Like,
mm-hmm.
And the 4 and 5, especially 4, feels mm-hmm. like, you know, you and I both know the work that needs to be done right now. I'm having trouble finding exactly the words for exactly the sins that I should be confessing
mm-hmm.
for, but I really want to confess it.
Uh-huh. So it's sort of a meta confession. Yeah. I need help with the actual. Right, and then you get into the world of, well, let me give you, you want confession words? Here's a ton of them. Here's like 3 pages worth of them. By the way, just a quick glance at, so you can see how that works. Look at page 5 for 1 second. This is what it used to be, okay? Yom Kippur sermons longer, machzor shorter. That was true except for the sermon part. Okay, look at 5. Ikar vidui, the essence of vidui, is al-chet. That is to say, al-chet shechatan lefanecha, the long, long litany. And here's the siman of the al-chet, aleph rei shin, zayin samech gimel. 6 al-chet. What does that stand for? Ones, ratzon, shigaga, zadon, seter, galui. Different types of sins that I could do. That's the whole thing.
Where are you?
Sorry, page 5, source number 12. Aval herichubo, but they lengthened it. Visidru ba'alpha beta, and they made it into an alphabetical acrostic. By the way, the Rambam has alphabetical acrostic, just one alphabetical acrostic. We now have a double alphabetical acrostic, right? 2 olives, 2 bets, etc. So it can be, you know, it's sort of like, I'm praying for the words, I'm Rav, and you're reading Talia, and now it's like, okay, now we've got a lot of words that we're going to run through, and they keep growing. Okay, yeah, Gabi.
Going back to a question that you asked a minute ago, Shmuel might be saying, or so Rav says, you know, the secrets of the universe mm-hmm. and eternity, and Shmuel's like, no, it's not about that. It's like, this is about confession. We're not talking about the secrets of, you know, the heavens and all the stuff out there. We're talking about what's in the heart.
Yeah.
That's
right. I think that is another contrast you could draw between Rav and Shmuel, especially if they start the same, Atayodea, right? Atayodea, you know the secrets of the world. That's very big and collective and almost unfathomable. And then there's, you know, the secrets of the heart, meaning the personal, the me. You know, it's very, very local to, you know, to the davener. And Shmuel's trying to maybe focus it. Or maybe, you know, to say also the secrets of the world and the secrets of the heart are as infinite as each other. You could blow up the secrets of the heart. But yeah, I think that is another distinction between them. Yeah, Alex, you want to add?
One of them, number one seems to have a more generic idea. God just happens to know everything. Mm-hmm. Whereas number five, it seems like... the other way. Number four says God has the ability to know everything, whereas number five says God already knows everything. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Just the ability for God to choose to know or to actively search versus just passively know are two very different sides of
God's action. Right. That's interesting contrast as well. Okay, one more comment, then I want to look at one other aspect, the essence of vidui, because if you spaced out for the whole thing, we can give it to you in two words, all of vidui. Shira.
I'm wondering if, there's almost, I don't know if it's, like, necessarily, like, an anxiety of, like, causal in a way.
Yeah.
But, like, it seems that there's something that's, like, tied up with what that means to be, like, mysterious and, like, all-powerful and, like, also known and kind of, like, dust.
Mm.
And, like, I wonder if there's some sort of, like, distinction that's, like, oh, well, God, you know everything about me and all these resources, like, everything there is to know, but, like, you're so mysterious, so you're so powerful, but I can be known, so I'm dust.
Uh-huh, meaning the knowable versus the unknowable is the contrast.
That's almost kind of like something
that's part of what's right.
Yeah.
Right, a way of sort of expressing our own mortality in that we can be known, whereas God isn't. That's interesting. Okay, let's look at the top of page 5, source number 11. This is, again, if you're following in the Gemara, this is just the next part of the Gemara. After the list of all these 7 versions of vidui, we have the following statement from Marzutra. Marzutra says, Lo amran ela delo amar aval anachnu chatanu. Aval, amar aval anachnu chatanu, tu lo tzarich. Okay? Marzutra has a theory, which is, those confessions are only said if you didn't say the phrase aval anachnu chatanu, but we have sinned. By the way, I said it was 2 words because in most manuscripts it's just aval chatanu. But, or some manuscripts anyways. But okay, 2-3 words, whatever, it's short. But if you said aval anachnu chatanu, you don't need to say any more. And do we know this from the liturgy as well? Where do we say it? Yeah, right before Ashamnu, right? Tavo lefanecha tefilatenu v'alti talim mitchinatenu she'en ananu azei panim ukshei orf lomar lefanechna lomar lefanechna lomar lefanecha what? Tzadikim anachnu v'lo chatanu aval anachnu chatanu, right? It's not that we should say that we're at tzadikim and we have no sins aval anachnu chatanu, but actually we've sinned. And then you start the Ashamnu, okay? And how do we know that this is the essence of vidui? Damar bar hamduti, somebody who never shows up again in all of the Talmud. Okay, but he has a great name. Havakaimna kame de Shmuel. I went to Shmuel's minion. I was standing before Shmuel, v'havayati, if he was sitting. V'chimata shlicha de tzibura, when the shliach tzibur, when the leader got to v'amar aval anachnu chatanu, kame kam. Shmuel stood up when the Shliach Tzibur said, Aval anachnu chatanu. And then he says, Shema Mina, we learn from this, Ikar vidui haihu. This is the essence of vidui. Okay, which you could indicate by standing, which is also part of why we stand, but we're standing for most of Yom Kippur anyway, so you can't totally learn from that now. But apparently Shmuel wasn't, and this was the moment when he stood up. So there's something about the essence of vidui that's captured simply in the words, Aval anachnu. Chatanu. You see now in many machzor, and they also add the word ba'avotenu. Anachnu ba'avotenu chatanu, but that's a much later addition. So it's just aval anachnu chatanu. That's the essence of vidui. Now, if you're going to boil down confession, admission, thanking if you want to say, to aval anachnu chatanu, what is it about aval anachnu chatanu that's so significant? Right? Now, here we have no detail. Right? It's just, I mean, this is the, in a Knotts reading, this is getting very simple, right? It's just cutting right to the chase. We have sinned. Now, could you say it better? Even better than aval anachnu chatanu? Anachnu chatanu. Or how about just chatanu? Okay? So just to say, because you don't have to have the subject, it's conjugated here at the end. So why not go down to one word? This is what I want to argue to, that the aval is significant, okay? The aval is significant. You could have just said, by the way, it was said, you wake up in the morning, you're in Eretz Yisrael liturgy, you say chatati, right? Not ani chatati, not aval ani chatati, just chatati. So they definitely could have followed that. So why is aval significant here? Yeah.
I think because the aval means no matter what I say to you before this, if I try to justify myself, if I say you're so great, no matter what, the bottom line is I really sinned. So I think the aval is to show that there's really nothing that God, that I can do, that I really can do that would excuse myself, or that your mercy doesn't still recognize my sin.
Good. I think the aval is a turning point in the admission. Think about it. How many excuses do we make for ourselves about our behavior, right? Either explicit or implicit, until we get to the point where we're able to say aval, right? All those excuses, all those, I mean, there's an introduction that's written to it, which is like, oh, we're tzaddikim. No, but actually we're not, right? Meaning the shift here is with the word aval. Aval is all of a sudden, now we're talking for real, okay? Now, I want to suggest an additional way of reading this, which those of you who learned liturgy with me before, we're not doing this for most of the Machzor because it would take a long time, but to trace it back to the Bible. But I actually think that this is significant because the word aval, even though in modern Hebrew, is very, very common, right? In the Torah, only shows up three times, aval. It's an extremely rare word, okay? And I want to bring you the one that I think this is quoting, which if you turn to the bottom of page 9, on the tell me if you remember where we are in the Bible, bottom of page 9. On the third, source 18, or source whatever, not numbered. Verse 18. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you shall live, for I am a God-fearing man. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be held in your place of detention, while the rest of you go and take home rations for your starving households. But you must bring me your youngest brother, that your words may be verified and that you may not die." Where are we in the Joseph narrative? Yeah, the brothers are coming down to Egypt for the first time, right? But they don't bring Benjamin. And Joseph accuses them of being spies. They say, "We're not spies, we're just here to get food." Right? And says, "If you're telling the truth, bring back Benjamin and leave one of your brothers here in as a surety." And they did accordingly. Vayomru, now I'm in verse 21, they said to one another, Vayomru ish el achiv, aval ashemim anachnu, alachinu, asher ra'inu tzarat nafsho, behidchanenu eilenu, velo shamanu, alkein ba eilenu atzara hazot. Now remember, Joseph and the brothers can speak freely in Hebrew because they think that no one understands them, right? They have the interpreter that's there between. But what they say to each other is, aval ashemim anachnu, indeed, or as the Targum translated, in truth, bekushta. Aval doesn't really mean but here because it starts off the sentence and your sixth grade English teacher knows you can't start a sentence with but. So it means something else, truly, right? Emet, be'emet, in truth, we are guilty. Right? This is the brothers, all the brothers are finally admitting that they have incurred guilt when, and now we get some detail about their original sin to Joseph, right? Al-achinu, on our brother, that we saw his anguish when he was crying out. Litchanein, he was tchina. He was pleading with us. He's not in the pit, you know, just playing tiddlywinks. He's like screaming out, "Will you save me?" And we heard that, and we ignored him. That's what the brothers did when they were trying to get rid of him. That's why this bad thing is happening to us right now. Okay? So what I want to argue is when we say, aval anachnu chatanu, aval ashemim anachnu, right? You're actually adopting the stance of the brothers who committed one of the worst crimes in our people's history, right? Who tried to murder, but then thought, no, let's make a few bucks on it, right? And never really admitted their guilt until this very moment here, right? That's part of the, I said that the core narrative of Yom Kippur is the Egel HaZahav, is the sin of the golden calf. But I want to argue that there's a sub-narrative, which is the story of the brothers of Joseph selling away Joseph himself. That is to say, one is a sin against God, the sin of the golden calf, the worst sin against God that you could do, idolatry, and the other is pretty much the worst sin you could do to another person, right? You more or less kill them, but instead of killing them, you take them for dead and also get some money when you do that transaction, right? And he's your brother. And by the way, he was crying out to you, and you didn't save him when he was pleading with you. Yeah.
I feel like that raises one of the questions we've been asking again, which is, did they confess by confessing it among themselves, or did they confess because he heard them? Because they're not actually confessing to him.
Correct. They by the way, they didn't make this association out of the blue. Right? I mean, maybe because they remember they sold them to slavery in Egypt, but they have no awareness. Right, so does it count as a confession? He sort of only by chance hears their confession. It's like if you're walking by the synagogue and the shofar's blowing, does it count for you or not, right? So I think the last piece of this puzzle of the sub-narrative is it comes out again in the liturgy in one other place, which is what we often call the martyrology, right? The martyrology is the story of the death, the martyrdom of 10 rabbis, okay? And this is told in poetic form during the day on Yom Kippur. It's one of the slichot, one of the piyutim that we find in the middle of the Amidah. But do you remember there's a narrative beginning to these horrible martyrdom stories? That is to say, it's not just that they come out of the blue. It's not just the Romans decided to have a persecution. But the way the story is told in the Midrash, which the poem is drawing upon, is as follows. Take a look at the last source, page 10, at the bottom. Okay, this is great, and we're going to end with this. When the Holy Blessed One created the trees, they were proud of their height and stretched themselves higher and higher. But when the Holy Blessed One created iron, they lowered themselves and said, "Woe to us, the Holy Blessed One already created the thing which will cut us down." Okay, that is to say, trees got all haughty until they met an axe, and then you're not going to be so tall anymore. So too, the destruction of the temple. The haughty ones of the generation were proud, and they said, "What?" Tell me if you've ever heard anybody say this. "What have we lost with the destruction of the temple? Behold, we have among us Torah scholars who will guide the world in his Torah and commandments." Okay? The temple. Sacrifice. You know what? Judaism's even better for the destruction of the temple because we don't have to kill animals anymore and we've got rabbinic Judaism. Okay? I like that so much more than what we are mourning on Tisha B'Av. Okay? Forget the temple. We've got the Torah. Okay? How does this play out? Immediately, the Holy Blessed One gave into the heart of the Caesar of Rome to learn the Torah of Moses from the wise ones. Okay? I love this. Yes, Caesar, in between geopolitics, is learning Parsha. Okay? He's learning also with Jews, right? With the people who can teach him. He's got a private tutor. He starts with the book of Genesis, and he learns straight through until he came to Ve'ela Mishpatim, Exodus 21, and he learns the following law. He says, when he came to the verse, "One who steals a man and sells him," right? What happens to a person who, Gonev ish umicharo vigomer, what's the vigomer? When you steal, but really when you kidnap a person and sell him, what's the punishment? Death. That's the punishment for kidnapping and selling, is death. So, what happens? He commanded to fill the palace with shoes, which is for the significance. See that? Okay. He sent for the 10 sages of Israel, the 10 rabbis who were going to be martyred, right? They came before him. He seated them in chairs of gold. He said to them, I have a deep question of law to ask you. Just tell me the law and the truth and the rule. They said, go ahead. He said, a person who steals another from his brethren, who kidnaps a person of Israel and mistreats him and sells him, what's his judgment? What's the rule in this case? They said to him, the Torah says, Motimat, he shall surely die. He answered and said to them, if so, you are liable for death. You yourself face the death penalty. They said, why? He said to them, because of the sale of Joseph, that his brothers sold him. If they were still alive, 10 of them, right? I would judge them, but they aren't alive. So you will bear the sin of your ancestors. That is to say, the martyrology in this sort of origin story is not about a random Roman persecution that comes out of nowhere and sort of recalls all the suffering of the Jewish people. Oh, that's sort of a side note to it. It actually goes back to the core sin of Israel to Israel, which is when the brothers kidnapped Joseph, tried to kill him, and sold him off. And they had a death penalty judgment against them, but they never actually got caught and punished. Right? They got away with it, basically.
So this is like the reverse of Zechut Avot.
That's right. The reverse of Zechut Avot. The martyrs are martyrs because they're paying penance. They stand in for the 10 brothers of Joseph who did this original sin of the inter-Jewish fighting. So as I say, the core narrative of Yom Kippur is the sin of the golden calf. But the sub-narrative that comes out in Aval Anachnu Chatanu, Aval Hashemim Anachnu, but we have sinned, truthfully we have sinned, against our fellow Jews, and we never quite paid the punishment for that, and that sin is going to rear itself at some point, and that's part of what we're also admitting on this day. That's part of the confession that we do, is to say, we have sinned against each other. Okay? So we're going to stop here. We've got Slichot, we've got Vidui, we're ready to go into Yom Kippur. We're never ready. Thank you for joining this class.